What's going on, guys? Welcome to the show. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy on this very special Wednesday afternoon. It is a special day. We're covering the most exciting adventure film of all time. It's Jurassic Park! Oh my god, guys, we're 98 episodes in. This is unbelievable. I can't believe it. It took us almost 100 episodes to get to Jurassic Park. We're so excited. Hang out with us. We're going to break the whole thing down for you. We'll see you in just 1 second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! What's up, everybody? Welcome to the show. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy.
There it is.
Yeah, there it is. John Williams.
John Williams.
Right, it is John Williams. I'm not making that up.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, I hope we're not just dead wrong. People, immediately dislike. Turn the show off. Guys, welcome to the show. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy. This is the show where we talk about action movies on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated to talking pop culture, bucketfuls of pop culture. And that's what we're doing. Jurassic Park, one of the most iconic pieces of pop culture of all time, actually.
Ever. Yeah, definitely.
Ever. This movie is iconic and classic and impactful for so many reasons. And I gotta say, I hadn't watched Jurassic Park in over a decade. I hadn't gone back to watch it in over 10 years.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, we recently made the discovery that James Cameron is actually the most timeless director of all time. But there's something about Spielberg's movies and the creatures in them.
Yep.
Jaws, E.T., the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yep.
That is just so iconic. That just live on for so long in such a different way than Titanic does. You know what I mean?
100%. And what's really crazy is, like, when you put those two guys... You put those two guys' movies and what they've created in cinema history, and you wonder, like, what percentage of iconography in American film history are James Cameron and Steven Spielberg collectively responsible for? Are they responsible for, like, 4 or 5% of, like, the most iconic things ever in movies? Two guys. Like, it's not as high as 10, but,
right,
like...
because, like, you, when you talk... It's like, immediately you want to be like, oh, like, probably 30%.
Yeah.
But, like, that's an insane number.
That's outrageous.
Yeah, but for them, it's got to be... I mean, I would say even maybe close to 10. Because you think about...
Yeah.
The things they created and, like... Hell, I've been on a movie set for the last couple weeks, and the amount of times we've talked about Spielberg and Cameron movies and creatures and Alien and Terminator and things like that, it's crazy. Even E.T. was brought up a few times.
So, like, just quickly, guys, well, we'll do it in a minute, because I think I have an interesting exercise here. But, guys, we talk action movies on the show. The action movies on this show adhere to four basic rules. Rule number one, the hero always plays by their own rules. Yeah, I mean, Sam Neill does, sort of. I mean, Goldblum.
Goldblum and him are like, we talk about this.
The duo.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Goldblum really does play by his own rules. The hero and the villain are always the smartest people in the room, and this is a classic one, because it's the T-Rex and Sam Neill are very much the smartest people in the room.
Absolutely.
You know, it's always like, you don't understand nature, or whatever. It's, like, it's that attitude.
You can't control it.
Yeah. And then three, the movie is driven by a police, military, political, or mercenary figure. Total swing and a miss on this one. He's a paleontologist. He's a paleontologist.
Yeah, a paleontologist.
And rule number four, the movie contains a minimum of one explosion.
Chaos theory.
Is there no explosion in this movie?
I mean, you could maybe try to... I feel like there is one later on. But you could maybe try to argue that the shotgun blast in the beginning...
Sure.
Shooter!
Yeah. So that's where we stand, guys. Those are the four basic rules. Some of our movies break those rules. This one feels like it breaks them pretty clearly. But, guys, if you enjoy the show, if you want to follow along, of course, join the conversation. You can find us on Twitter at AMA Podcast is where you can find this podcast on Twitter. You can find me personally at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram.
And you can find me at Andrew Guy and the same two platforms.
Yes, and, of course, I do a show now called Fist Pump Film School. Mm. Sorry, Fist Pump Film Club on Anchor. It's a brand new app. You can download anchor.fm. It's basically radio meets podcasting. It's little 2-3 minute blurbs like Snapchat that fall off every day, talking about movies and the best movies. It's very inspired by this show, and I did a whole bunch of stuff this week about Jurassic Park and Jeff Goldblum, and go find that. It's a lot of fun. It's a very fun app, and you can interact. You can call in. I can hear your thoughts, share your thoughts. So.
Yeah, we've definitely had viewers from this show call in and interact with you on there, and again, like he said, it was based off of this show.
Yep.
I helped co-create this show, so I'll pop in on there every now and then. I was actually on a few of your anchors. It's a lot of fun. It's cool. It's just kind of like it's tangential, and it's also a little more open structure.
It's
not like you're sticking to something,
which is the best part. You can do it real quick where you're, you know, waiting in line somewhere. You can get through like the whole day's content.
Yeah, we started. We were just talking about watching Jurassic Park for the first time in a long time, and then the second one we did was about the trailer, which we're going to cue right now. Yeah, we'll save our discussion for after we cue the trailer.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's cue the trailer.
Yeah.
It's a horrible trailer.
It's not a good one.
Bad trailer.
A photographer with an eye for
it's a good thing he's got that voice. I forgot. It's a great voice.
Welcome to Jurassic Park. We've made living biological attractions so astounding that they'll capture the imagination of the entire planet.
The most phenomenal discovery of our time. Becomes the greatest adventure of all time.
You may recognize the voice from the trailer for Congo, also Michael Crichton.
Sure. Universal Pictures presents.
You feel that?
Hold on to your butts.
It's funny because
a Steven Spielberg film.
After recently watching it, the trailer is way
that's
better.
Feeling all over the park.
Yeah, that's nice. Gotta go.
An adventure.
Look out! Go!
That dinosaur
with Jurassic Park back online.
Yeah.
I think it became the most iconic dinosaur in the movie other than the T-Rex.
Yeah.
I mean, that's hard to say.
Jurassic Park.
Visually iconic, I think it's the most.
Which is funny because those are all not real things.
Yeah, right.
That dinosaur doesn't actually spit any acid or anything.
And it doesn't have
it. It doesn't have the feathers, but
it just has like the ridge on its face or whatever. Yeah.
But it looks awesome.
It's so cool looking. Well, I think that's what I was going to say is like for the action figures. I think that that became visually the most iconic of all the dinosaurs.
For sure, because everyone had Tyrannosaurus Rex and Raptors toys already. That was the one that, like, when it opened, you were like, oh.
It was cool looking.
Yeah, and it shot little missiles, I think, out of it. Yeah, I remember that.
Terrifying. So, anyway, guys, this is the show we're going to talk about, Jurassic Park. Here, we're going to break the whole thing down for you. Andrew and I actually did the episode for Jurassic World early on in this show. It was like
a year ago now, right?
Oh, really?
It was like, oh, Jesus.
Close to 2 years ago. And we didn't love Jurassic World. We thought that movie was just okay. Yep. It lost us a little bit. I do wonder, had we just watched this again and then went and watched Jurassic World, if we'd love it? Because I did recognize some things, like, for instance, when you watch Force Awakens, there's a lot of Force Awakens that is like, this is just Star Wars again, but for a new generation. And they referenced a lot of the original New Hope stuff in that movie to make it appealing. And it was for that reason. I think if we had watched Jurassic World, there's a good chance that we would have loved, or sorry, Park, we would have loved World in kind of the same way.
I can see that. I can see enjoying it more because you're like, you're back in it, you know, you're like ready for the next thing.
Yeah.
I do think that they, I just think like with Bryce Dallas Howard's character, they didn't give her enough, and like Vincent D'Onofrio being a bad guy.
Yeah.
You don't need that. You got dinosaurs as your bad guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it was just okay. But in any case, guys, we are talking Jurassic Park. So let's continue to move through the way we do this show, which is that we get into thesis statement next.
Mm-hmm.
Thesis statement is that it's that bold thought you have about the film, something really strong, rooted almost in like hyperbole. You want it to be your strongest opinion about the movie that you can kind of defend all throughout. And I had a couple, but I think the one I'm going to jump in with first is Jurassic Park is Disneyland the movie. And I thought about this a lot because I had a couple others that I had gone to, but when I say Disneyland the movie, this is what I mean. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Disneyland. Some of you probably have. Some of you have probably been to World or some of the other parks. I've been to Disneyland 25 times. I used to go as a kid every year, once a year. I have an annual pass now.
Jesus, I didn't even know all this about you.
It's drivable, so you can, it's right, 45 minutes away. But there's this thing when you go to Disneyland, and Disney appeals to different people for different reasons, but the big thing about Disneyland is you're there, and it's fun, and it's bright, and it's colorful. It definitely captures the imagination. And there's this thing that we all do, the suspension of disbelief while you're there, where you...
Yeah.
It's not actually dangerous. The roller coaster aren't really dangerous. It's not actually scary to be on Pirates of the Caribbean. It's just there's this quaint sort of feeling. It's the reason that Disneyland is so fun. You immerse yourself in
it. Completely. It's a completely immersive world. Everything.
Yeah. You just allow... And it's so fun, all of it. Waiting in line, being on the rides. Like, it is such a perfect thing. And what you realize when you watch this movie is... This movie is just that, except instead of suspending your disbelief, they've replaced it with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And it is in the movie, it is actually dangerous, but it's a movie, so it's not really dangerous, so it still has that same thing. And then when you talk about when you go to Disneyland, there is just branding and licensing everywhere. There's so many toys, there's so many things you can buy. This movie, like, there's even a shot where they show the gift shop.
Right, and everything in the gift shop is things that you can actually buy.
They're all for sale. Yeah. They're all really for sale. And like just watching this movie, Spielberg captures Disneyland in a movie in a way that I think no director ever alive could have.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to just completely piggyback on that and saying that Steven Spielberg appeals to the kid and viewers better than any other director. There's something about the way that he does things in films, and his attention to detail and insignificant detail is another beautiful thing that we've talked about in Minority Report and Saving Private Ryan. In this film, the shaving cream on the pie is a great example.
It's funny, too, right? Because we both looked at that when that happened, and we both remembered visually that moment.
We were like, that, from being a kid. I was like, I remember that. I always want it. And then, like, you know, one thing that people love is, like, the dinosaur scratching itself. But to go back to what you were saying about being a kid and being on a ride in this is, you watch this movie and from the very beginning with, like, the creature that you can't see that pulls the guy in to the next scene where they're, like, gently dusting off the dinosaur bones and then an explosion afterwards. It's just, when you watch this movie, when you watch his movie specifically, he makes you feel like a kid in a way that other directors don't. Most of their movies, you feel like it because of, like, nostalgia.
Yeah.
Whereas this, like, you just kind of feel like a kid watching it again.
Well, and something that's so incredible about this, you mentioned the visuals, but, like, that's something that I think Spielberg is better at than anyone ever. And that's that you think about the number of things. So this is what I was just going to say. This is right before we started.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about Cameron and Spielberg and the number of iconic things they've created in the history of movies, right? So let's just quickly list a few like things that jump out at us between their two films that are like actually visually forever. So like, okay, the vibrating water that signifies the T-Rex.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
That is an all-time movie moment. I was watching that and I was like, wow, he came up with that. That's we associate that now, but he came up with it.
Yeah, and the thing was is that the guy that was in charge of figuring out how to do it was like, yeah, we can do it. And he had no idea how.
Yeah.
And they finally figured it out later on with putting guitar strings underneath the dashboard and twing, and that's what made it happen. So you've got that.
E.T. going through the moon.
I was going to say E.T. flying through the moon, right? What about just the Queen Alien in general, if you're talking
just
about James Cameron?
Shot, we'll get away from her, you bitch.
But yeah.
One of those two things, the visual of the Queen Alien, is seared into our memories.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, the Queen Alien for sure.
The T2 coming back together after the explosion.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. That's super iconic. There's 100 Arnold as Terminator. I'll be back.
The reverse shot of the face hugger, like making that happen.
Yeah, right.
Filming it in reverse.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's such a, like, James Cameron doing that. He invented that.
Other stuff that jumps out that are super, super famous. The spinning boulder in Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yep. I think that's probably, I feel like that's right up there with the
most
famous.
I mean, just the fin.
Jaws. And the music. The fin and the music together.
Yeah.
Right? The Jaws music. Like, I mean, it's crazy because you just keep going. Like, Schindler's List, the red feature in Schindler's List.
Yep.
Just the color of red in the black and white film.
Or James Cameron inventing practical 3D filming. Like, the actual real 3D filming in Avatar.
In Avatar. What is another one? It just came to mind that I just, like, forgot. Cameron.
The Normandy.
Yeah, the beginning beach in SPR. But then Catch Me. Titanic.
Yeah.
The front of the boat. I mean,
it's
like
one of the most famous scenes ever in
the history of movies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy when you start to think about this. You're like, these are all things that were created by these two guys.
Just these two people, and not any one person watching this show would not know about these things.
Right.
They're all iconic.
Like, incredibly, like game-changing iconic.
Yeah.
It's crazy to me. I don't know. I mean, we could just keep going. I mean, that's the thing, is you could probably name 25 of these, and if you were going to make the 500 most iconic movie moments in the history of American film, there's probably 25 to 30 of them that they're just these two
just
guys.
Just these two guys. Yeah. Absolutely.
So at least 5%.
Yeah.
I feel like that's maybe that right there.
We can make a
so
rule
abstract.
Somewhere?
Oh,
absolutely.
So abstract.
We can make it happen.
Yeah. So anyway, guys, that's where we start with this. So thesis statements, we've covered them now. You did share your thesis statement?
Yeah, it was just basically about the appealing to the kid in you as a viewer. Yeah,
it's the greatest ever, that. Mm-hmm. So moving on, guys, we're going to get into the next part of the show. This is Fist Pump Moments, that moment you're watching the movie, something happens, you're like, oh, this is so sweet. This is the coolest thing I've ever seen. Are you seeing this right now? I'm so fucking into this. You just want to watch the rest of the movie. You know, we like to say the greatest films of all time have one thing in common, and that is that they are made up by a series of great fist pump moments.
They are a 2-hour-long series of fist pump moments.
And the history of movies is punctuated by the greatest fist pump moments of all time. That's the theory we've been creating on this show. Which, by the way, that's a small teaser for something that's upcoming that we'll get into later.
Big things.
Yeah, let's get into our fist pump moment.
This is so tough because, like you just said. I mean, from that's Chaos Theory to the squeal. We got dots in here. Like, these are all things you remember, but the amazement on Neil and Dern's faces is what makes this movie happen. Like, they sell it so well. That first scene when he sees the dinosaur and he pulls off his glasses and he stands up and he grabs her head and turns, and then she stands up and pulls off her glasses, and then he goes out and he falls to his knees, and Sam Neill says, he's like, I couldn't faint.
Yeah.
You know, we're filming, but I needed something. It's like something like that would bring you to your knees in that look, and then welcome to Jurassic Park and the wide pan with all the dinosaurs. Yeah. Like, you just get this rush. Yeah. Of like, yes, yeah. I want to be there. I want to watch this. It's going to go bad. Yeah. It's going to go real bad, but I can't wait to see it happen.
But it's not bad yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you just want to be there.
Yeah. The setup is just wonderful.
Yeah.
For me, the first thing I noticed about this movie was 15 or 20 minutes into watching this, I kind of looked over at you and I was like, wow, this is like picture perfect movie making. It's like, it's like there hasn't been a wasted frame yet.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what I was just going to say.
I was like, can you imagine reading this script? I was like, reading the script, you would just be like, this is the most exciting thing I've ever read. And it is. You're watching the movie and you just can't believe how good it is. There's no, I mean, okay, we talk about those iconic moments and you think about movies that you like, even some movies you love have two or three or four of those moments.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't hold up in the way that they, like every single shot, every single scene, piece to piece to piece, they don't hold together in the way that this does. So
there's no, yeah, there's no frame, there's no second of this film that is wasted.
Yeah,
at all.
All of it. And you realize how many of them you remembered as a kid and they still hold up. So, you know, I was going to do a Goldblum fist pump, but I'll save it.
Yeah.
I think probably the fist pump for me right away is when he's explaining, Sam Neill is explaining what raptors do to that little kid.
So good.
Little kid's like, I'm not that scared. They don't look that scary. And Neill's like, let me explain to you what a raptor does.
Yeah.
And you're just like, by the way, the voice, the trailer voice, I'm sure they were like, it was so successful in Jurassic Park that actually we're just going to use the same trailer voice for Michael Crichton's next movie, Congo,
yeah.
Which turned, the only reason Congo was such a big deal when it came out was because it was the next adapted Crichton book after Jurassic Park. And that movie turned out to be kind of a flop and not very good.
Super awesome.
But the trailer is fantastic and the voice and the trailer. Voice.
A diamond mine of incredible bounty.
I wonder at this point the number of times we've imitated that guy's voice. If we were to like record one of us doing a sentence, then play it next to the trailer, how close we could actually get.
I wonder how close it would be.
Yeah.
Bars are, we definitely need to get a little lower.
Yeah.
A diamond mine of incredible bounty.
Incredible bounty.
Yeah. Something.
Yeah. Our fans are just like, what is
what
going
are you
on?
Guys talking about? So for me, I think it's that scene. He's talking about the raptor and the way the raptor's claw cuts. He's like, it doesn't slice you like he slices you here and here. So your intestines fall out.
Yeah. Or he's like, he doesn't hit you from the front, but from the sides.
Yeah.
You know, because they attack in packs. You're just like, Jesus.
Yeah. That's the thing is like the setup in this movie. Again, it's another one of those things where you're like, this just, it's picture perfect screenwriting because the way it sets up, you get the payoff later in the film with the hunter trying to take on the raptors, but he comes at him from the side, and it's like these simple things that you're like, oh, they're so, you know, they're truly as deadly as they are cunning.
Yeah, yeah. No, but that was a thing that we really noticed, and I'm sure that's pretty relevant in all Spielberg films. That's why he's such a great director, but I don't know why in this film, maybe it's because we hadn't seen it in so long and we were maybe expecting a little less out of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, we watched it in two parts. We watched it up until the first T-Rex attack because it was so late and we were very exhausted. But that was, up until that point, there was not a single scene that we were just like, this is perfect.
Right.
This is absolutely perfect. And it's so crazy how much time people waste in movies. And he still made a two-hour movie without wasting any time.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It was unbelievable. The two hours flew by in the end.
Yeah.
So anyway, guys, let's move on to the next bit of the show. And that is discussing Mr. Jeff Goldblum, because we're gonna get into star profiles.
Yeah.
And as much as I want to talk about Sam Neill and Laura Dern, look, Sam Neill and Laura Dern are fine. The star of this movie is Jeff Goldblum and the T-Rex. That's like that's who stars in this movie.
Definitely.
And this picture right here is almost my fist pump moment because that's a real frame from the movie.
Yeah, Spielberg saw that. He's like, perfect.
Yeah. He's like, what? Like, Goldblum shows up and he's in like the black and all the leather and you're just like, who is this guy? Because Attenborough even says the line. You know, what's he say?
I brought you scientists, you brought a rock star.
Yeah, something like that. And you're like, so they're really trying to sell that he is this rock star. So I'm sure Spielberg was like, yeah, he's got his leg all cut up and he's still just laying there like a Lothario. Kind of like a gigolo.
Oh, another thing I was going to say is that Spielberg did say that he wanted Attenborough to be the dark Walt Disney.
Yeah, right.
Which
I read that.
Which was so interesting about your thesis.
Yeah. So Goldblum, just like the Goldblum splayed out thing, gets us discussing.
Yeah, it gets us discussing over under properly rated for Jeff Goldblum, because while doing this, while watching this, you realize, like you said, that Jeff Goldblum is truly the star of this. And it's not even I mean, he does completely steal the show, whether it's intentional or not, but he has so much on-screen charisma.
Yeah.
Everything he says, everything he does is so interesting and so weird and quirky that you can't take your eyes off of him. So my question, the discussion I want to bring up, is the over-under properly rated for Jeff Goldblum. Jeff Goldblum also starred in The Fly, which is a cult classic, yep, and Independence Day,
yep,
in the 90s, which was one of the biggest films ever. So,
unless I'm mistaken, this and Independence Day, respectively, were the highest grossing films of 1993 and 1996. And he is the star of both movies in my mind.
Absolutely, he's the star of both of them. Going back and watching both films, he is what stands out the most.
Yeah, which is funny, because we thought Will Smith was the star of that movie. We were dead wrong.
We were. Yes. We were dead wrong. And I thought that Jeff Goldblum was the star of this movie, and he's not. It's Sam Neill and Laura Dern.
Yeah.
Like, going back and looking at the actual billing.
Yeah. So the question is, over or under proper? So, all right, first and foremost, let's talk about one thing. Jeff Goldblum, he is revered as kind of a classic actor, mm-hmm, but he's never had an Oscar nomination.
Yep.
His Oscar nomination that he does have is for like a short film or something like that, but he's never a traditional Oscar nom for a leading or supporting actor role. He's never written anything or directed anything. He's just kind of become a part of what I described the other day on Anchor as the Chuck Norris theory.
Yeah.
Which is, he's kind of one of these actors, like Swayze when Swayze was alive, where there's this fascination people have with them.
It's like Patrick Stewart now.
Yes.
Except for that, now that he's back in Logan, it takes, yeah, away. But it was like, why are you so obsessed with Patrick Stewart?
Yeah, it's these kind of actors and actresses that have this kind of bankability where, like, there's this cool factor, this, yeah, kind of enigmatic cool factor that's just associated with them.
And kind of weird.
Yeah, the biggest actor now that I can think of that has taken on this personality far more than his acting is Nicolas Cage.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Malkovich.
No, Cage has become this guy because, like, people don't care about Cage's acting anymore.
Oh, no.
But there's a billion Nick Cage memes online. He's the easiest actor to make fun of, and he is instantly recognizable to, like, anybody of any age because he still gets referenced almost as much as anyone.
Yeah.
So it's like that whole Chuck Norris can do this, Chuck Norris can do that thing. Goldblum has kind of taken on a similar personality, but he did it a few years ago, so you realize when he shows up in stuff like The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, great character.
He's so good in that.
He's just this, like, weird character in movie after movie.
Yeah, there's this awesome, like, four-frame meme out there of Jeff Goldblum, and it's like, the first one's like, people always come up to me and ask, is it Goldblum or Goldblum? And the next one's like, and I always say the same thing. And the next one's just like a pause. The fourth one is, how dare you speak to me? Fucking love it. He actually did it on some comedy short, but it's, yeah, he's just become one of those people that, like, he's become such a caricature of himself,
yeah,
that, yep, when you see him in things, he really has to pull off like a tour de force for you to, like, disconnect. Like Patrick Stewart,
yeah,
in Logan, again, it's like the whole number one and like mocking Next Generation and him,
yeah, right,
on Family Guy has become such a joke, but then he comes out and he does something like that.
That's what I would say. I have like a very interesting point of view on this. I have two opinions. Number one, my second thesis was Jeff Goldblum is the most underrated action star of the 1990s, and it's just strictly for the two films. But that's the 1990s, and that's two movies. The actual caricature of Goldblum that he's taken on, I would actually say he's overrated because he was not good in,
right,
Resurgence.
Right, right, right. I see what you're saying.
That movie sucked,
yeah,
and he didn't save it.
Nope.
He, like, the gimmick when you actually watch it isn't something that can save a movie. It's just like he's become this caricature. So I think actually the idea that if you put Goldblum in something, it just, like, elevates it in the way that if you put Denzel in something, it elevates it. It's not true.
Yeah, no.
So I think Goldblum's actually overrated. But I think in the 90s, in retrospect,
prime,
he's totally underrated.
I completely agree. Like, if for some reason they went and they went running with everyone else,
yeah,
other than him in his films, even though he was what made them so interesting. So I can agree with that. I can say in the 90s he was definitely underrated because I loved Independence Day. I loved Jurassic Park. And going back and watching Jurassic Park, he's the best part of it. And then, yeah, now whenever I see him in something, it's just, I can't not see Jeff Goldblum.
One of our fans called into my station and told me that they thought The Lost World's highly underrated. That actually,
I like The Lost
that
World.
Movie's pretty good,
yeah,
and it got pretty panned. Like, if you go and look at the awards,
that's the one with William H. and Julianne, right?
That's the William H. is in the third one. Julianne's in the second one.
Right.
The
right,
third
right.
one's the Raptor Language, right? And
I think
the second
so.
One's the one with Double T-Rex in San Diego.
I think so.
The
yeah,
second one,
yeah, yeah.
If I remember correctly, the scene, yes, it's Vince Vaughn's in the second one.
Yeah.
The scene in the second one that I remember is the, it's the bus goes over the edge and it's,
oh, and
they're on the glass,
yeah,
right in the back of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
I watched that in theaters with my dad, and
it's
I
creepy.
Yeah, it was really... That's a cool scene.
It's a good scene.
It's a good scene.
It was a good movie. I mean, well, at the time. And I think I only saw it in theaters.
Got nominated for some Razzies. But but yeah, I'd have to go back and watch it again. But in any case, he's the star of the second one, I think. Goldblum Returns. Mm-hmm. It's Goldblum, Vaughn, and Julianne Moore. And then the third one, I think, is H. Macy, and they bring Sam Neill back.
I think that's right.
And Tay Leone in the third one?
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Yeah, it's like Tay Leone and William H. Macy's kid goes missing on the island. They hire Sam Neill because he's been there before. And
yeah.
Craziness ensues.
Here's a piece of trivia for you that surprised me. What year did Jurassic Park 3 come out?
Jurassic Park 3? This was 90s.
I'll tell you. The first is 93. Lost World's 97.
2002?
2001.
One.
So you're really close. Yeah. I was way off. In my mind, and I had a realization the other day thinking about this. It's another one of those things where you think about our age and when we grew up and the kind of... Like, so Jurassic Park in 93 is just too old for us to have actually been cognizant of it being the movie that it was when it came out. We were five years old.
Yeah.
So it's by the time Lost World comes out, we're, like, old enough to understand that this is a movie we should care about, and it's dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time the Jurassic Park 3 came out, we felt like we had grown up, but we hadn't, obviously. In 2001, we were 13. But by 13, you're like, oh, I understand adult things. I like things that are cool.
Right.
So in my mind, I was like, the third one came out years later. It came out in like 2006 in my mind, right? No way. It was just a few years. Same thing with Alien Resurrection. I had the same experience where I was like, that was the Alien movie that came out in my lifetime.
Years later.
Yeah. And I was totally wrong. It was 4 years after Alien 3.
It just because it feels like such a different... film.
Yeah.
Different time in film as well. I totally forgot. So my thesis statement that I gave was like the one that I'd been thinking about for like 2 days, but it wasn't the one I wanted to give. The one that I wanted to give, I just blanked on, and it was that the DNA cartoon is the greatest use of exposition in a film ever to appeal to children. That's why it also...
Yeah.
That's why the whole appealing to children thing was set, because that was pure brilliance. Like, you and I watching that, we were like, holy shit, you just turned like a 200-page book into a 2-minute cartoon.
Yeah. Completely.
In a movie.
They're literally showing the cartoon, and you're watching, and you're like, oh, it all makes sense now.
Yeah.
You're like, and you didn't have to have a voiceover, and you didn't have to have some boring scientist explaining it to some other character who's in disbelief.
Nope.
It was a children's cartoon. We're totally engaged, and it explains everything.
2 minutes. Yeah. Done. Yeah, that was mind-blowing to me. That was like one of the coolest things in the whole film, so I'm so glad that you pulled that. All right, so to actually get into star profiles and breakdowns...
Oh, we've already done the star. We can move on.
It's weird, because this was a time in movies, with acting, where TV movies were a big thing.
Yeah.
So Sam Neill, two of his three credits were TV movies. The Rainbow Warrior and Family Pictures, both in 93, were TV films. And then there was The Piano, also in 93.
Yeah.
I don't know any of those. I think I maybe know The Piano.
Piano's a big movie. Piano was a big Oscar movie.
That was a big... Yeah.
Yeah, lots of nominations there.
And then Laura Dern, on the other hand, same thing. She was in Industrial Symphony No. 1, Dream of the Broken Hearted, which was a TV movie.
Okay.
And then Rambling Rose and Afterburn in 91 and 92. So... it was another one of those, like, we're going to pick some up-and-comers that aren't too expensive, that aren't going to distract from the film.
I don't know Afterburn. I believe, unless I'm mistaken, Laura Dern, she got her second Oscar nomination for supporting for Wild a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or Cake, was it? It was Cake, I think. Cake or Wild?
I can't remember. I looked at it this morning.
Yeah, it was one of the two. But her other one was Rambling Rose, I think. It's a lead actress nomination. Mm-hmm. She's the son of Bruce Dern, and that's... or the daughter of Bruce Dern, and that's, like, the big role, but weirdly enough... I've never heard of the movie, so...
Yeah, I don't... What's the deal with Laura Dern?
I mean, she has famous parents. She turned in some good work. She was 35 when they made this movie. It's like, this is prime role to be like a paleontologist. She's talented. She's been good in a lot of things.
She was just fine. She was just like a filler, maybe, in Hollywood.
Kinda, a little bit, I think, yeah. I think...
Because it's her and Twister, too, right?
No, that's Helen Hunt.
Helen Hunt, right. God damn it. I always get Helen Hunt, Jodie Foster, and Laura Dern mixed up.
Yeah. I think just okay is probably an understatement, because there's a lot of actresses that never received an Oscar nom, let alone two.
Oh, for sure.
So I think she's probably a little above average, but I think that there's the whole... when you have the famous family, it's like... you get a little bit grandfathered into getting the kind of roles that she gets. Bryce Dallas Howard is a famous daughter, so she gets to have the career. Not to say that either one of them is not good. It's just...
Or that people that aren't...
But yeah,
you know
Laura Dern...
I feel about all that.
Completely. And I mean, look, Laura Dern, she's been good in a lot of things. She has a lot of weird roles she shows up in. I think she's in... isn't she in that new show with Shailene Woodley?
I think she is. The Big Little Lies or whatever?
Big Little Lies, I think. And I think she's all... and then she's also in that movie a few years ago with Will Ferrell, Everything Must Go. She has a really great scene with him in that movie.
I like that movie a lot.
Yeah,
I actually just watched it again the other day.
Yeah, isn't she who he goes to see, writes in his yearbook? And he's like, you said I was a winner in high school. And she's like, I haven't seen you in like 20 years. And he's just like, tell me why you said that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah, it's good. It's Rebecca as well.
Which one?
Rebecca, not Ferguson, the other one from the town is in there, is the pregnant neighbor across the street.
Rebecca Hall.
Hall,
yep. That's right. Yep.
All
right,
so moving on to production development here. So there's a lot of really interesting little things, little tidbits that we found out. The T-Rex constantly malfunctioning due to the rain. It would just, like, turn on
and stuff.
And, like, people with Kathleen Kennedy was saying that she would just be like, we'd be sitting there eating lunch, and all of a sudden you'd hear people screaming. You don't know what's going on, and then you realize it was the T-Rex. So they had to start, like, putting platforms above him to keep him from getting too soaked and too heavy.
Freaking out.
Harrison Ford turned down the role that Sam Neill got.
Which is crazy because he says, after seeing the film, he says that he made the right decision. It's like, no, you didn't, actually.
Yeah, I think that's just him being a cock and being like, well, I just missed out on...
It's like Sam Neill is about as replacement... Like he is... The only thing keeping him above replacement level is that he's the star of Jurassic Park.
Right. Yeah. And like, this role is Harrison Ford's roles.
Harrison Ford
is the everyman action hero.
He should have been... This should have been a Harrison Ford movie, and had this been a Harrison Ford movie... Even the year, 1993, what Harrison Ford was doing from 93 to 97.
Oh, it was, do this instead.
Do this instead of the Jack Ryan movies. Yeah. Do Air Force One in 96.
Yeah, still do Air Force One.
But, though, like, aside from that, just don't do Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. Do The Fugitive and do this, and you're good. You're golden.
Yeah, it's weird because you wouldn't... In the back of my mind, as a movie critic, I want to be like, yeah, but I don't want to see another Spielberg-Ford collaboration after Indy. But then you're like, well, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
It's not like Indiana Jones, and it's not like this character. This character is so far detached, yet so similar that it wouldn't. I feel like it wouldn't bother you. You would just be like, awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where hindsight's 20/20, and who knows if he does this movie, if it's as good of a movie. Who knows if like his career is different? I don't know. I mean, you can't really say this movie should have had someone else when it's one of the great movies ever made. But in any case, I thought the other interesting thing here was that James Cameron stated that he wanted to make the film, but the rights were bought a few hours before he could bid.
In quotes. Donner was also fighting. Richard Donner was.
Yep.
And there was one more big one from back then.
Yeah, I saw
I can't remember
this.
Who.
But after seeing the film, what he said was he thinks that Spielberg was the right person to make it because his would have been much more violent and not as fair to children. He basically said it would have been like Aliens with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And he's probably right. I mean, there is a distinct difference in their two styles. And but it's funny, like, just the two of them, especially in that era, they're not really that way anymore.
It's interesting because they, exactly. Nowadays, it would be very rare that the two of them would be in fights over rights to a project.
Yeah.
They do such different things now, and Cameron only does Avatar. But it's super cool to kind of think about these guys back then, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, they're still the biggest directors in the world.
Yeah.
But they're not James Cameron and Steven Spielberg to the extent they are now.
It almost makes you feel like, actually, you know that show Feud they just made?
Oh, yeah, yeah. How I don't know about it, but...
It's like it's like famous feuds between Jessica Lange and... Betty Davis, and I'm getting it all mixed up. Anyway, it was a good show, from what I understood. I didn't watch it.
I know
it was good. But... Talking about other feuds that would have been awesome, Spielberg and Cameron as a feud.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know if they ever actually feuded.
No, but at the same, you know that in the back of their minds, every now and then, they're like, God damn,
the rivalry would have been
James.
Oh my God, like fictionalizing the rivalry would have been so cool.
Maybe that's what we write our action movie about,
right? Cameron and Spielberg,
Cameron and Spielberg, like as superheroes.
Yeah. That's amazing. Anyway, continue to move through here, guys. We're going to get into the people that made the film. So the two writers on this are Michael Crichton and David Koepp. So Crichton, we've talked about a lot of times, everything from Jurassic Park to Twister, Rising Sun, Sphere, Timeline, Westworld. Super, super famous writer. Like, definitely, I mean, like we said, Congo is his next novel. And he was already so famous by the time this one came out. He was paid $2 million for the rights to the book before it was published.
Yeah.
So this movie, this book came out in 89. They went into production on the film in 89. So it was a year earlier. And Crichton is just the guy. He's like, yeah, you give me $2 million and a significant part of the percentage on the film. And I'll let you make the movie.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Just like selling movie rights before a book even comes out is crazy.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what that's like.
Like, it still happens, but like, I don't think to that level.
No. And then
Co-op.
Yeah. American screenwriter and director. He's known for doing the first two Jurassic movies, as well as Mission Impossible, Indiana Jones, Temple of the Crystal Skull, Spider-Man, War of the Worlds. And he received $4 million for Panic Room with Jodie Foster and Forest Whitaker. which is, you know, good for you.
That's like one of those classic situations, though, where like you're that successful, you're that notable,
you're that guy,
you can get the $4 million script. Yeah, he's writing the script for the fifth Indiana Jones. He's actually currently the fifth most successful screenwriter in the history of U.S. box office with $2.3 billion.
I mean, when you've got an Indiana Jones movie, a Mission Impossible, and a Jurassic Park, and a Spider-Man under your belt, that's huge.
Yeah, and then but the funny part is, though, if you go look at the movies he directed, because he's a writer and a director,
terrible.
Stir of Echoes, Secret Window, Mordecai, that movie from last year with Gwyneth Paltrow and,
yeah, and Depp.
Johnny Depp.
Panic Room is also, I mean, not Secret Window is also Depp.
Yeah.
One thing that I thought was cool is that Co-op was like walking to a store or maybe to go pick up his morning paper or something. And he was walking by a theater that Jurassic Park was screening at, and he was new to this, and Jurassic Park had just opened, and he said he was walking by, and people walk. The person in the box house walked out. He was sorry, the 7 o'clock show sold out. People were like, aw.
Yeah.
Like, and the 10 o'clock show sold out. And they're like, aw. And tomorrow night's 7 and 10 o'clock show sold out.
Yeah.
And Saturday night's 7. And like, that was when he was like, I don't know a lot about movies.
Yeah.
But I feel like we made a really good movie.
Yeah. Yeah. That's got to be good news.
A cool feeling.
Yeah. That's wild.
You want to keep going here with this next little thing you got?
Oh, you're talking about this next bit that we're going to do?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, pretty much, you know, we can thank Michael Crichton and Dave Koff for creating the character of Ian Malcolm. I think that I think we're all pretty thankful for the character of Ian Malcolm.
Yes.
And in the theme of what we used to do with Action Movie Tagline, sometimes we do something called Call It a Spinoff or the Pitch Your Spinoff. Andrew and I have both decided to pitch our best Ian Malcolm spinoff in a competition. So if you're watching or listening, tweet at us at AMA Podcast, at Ben Bateman Media, at Andrew Guy. Let us know who you think wins the Ian Malcolm spinoff film. Now, this is a non-Jurassic spinoff, so it shouldn't involve dinosaurs. I mean, it can. I don't really give a shit. But mine doesn't involve dinosaurs.
Mine doesn't involve dinosaurs either.
Marissa, is there any chance we could get a little timer up there? We got Marissa Serafini up in the booth, by the way. Marissa, how you doing?
It's actually Steve right now.
Oh, Steve!
What's up, Steve? How you doing?
Hey, doing good.
Steve, where can people find you? Or can they not?
They cannot.
You don't exist. You're a creature of the night.
I love it. We don't need a timer, because we just get to do the pitch. Just a pitch.
Okay.
Just go through it.
Fair enough. Never mind. Forget the timer.
Do you want to go first?
Oh, you can go first.
All right.
Ian Malcolm, the movie.
Ian Malcolm, the movie. Years after the disaster at Jurassic Park, a crazed Ian Malcolm goes into hiding in Middle America. Spinoff. It's him as a grocery store manager that believes chaos theory is involved in everything, especially how you stock the shelves. He's become so obsessed with chaos theory and stocking the shelves as such that the people of the town have started to worry and stopped frequenting his stores. This made Dr. Ian Malcolm very upset. He started to stalk people of the town that looked like Dr. Ellie Sattler and brainwashing them into becoming his muses. And now he's got an army of Ellie Sattler lookalikes that are murdering people in Middle America.
How does it conclude?
Dude, you gotta watch the movie.
Holy moly. Wow.
That coming, did you?
No, I was gonna use the serial killer angle, and I decided not to use it, so I'm glad you chose to use it.
Okay. You're welcome.
Years before the Jurassic
Park.
It's
called Chaos Clerks.
Did you just make that right now?
No, it's written down.
Years before the Jurassic Park debacle, Professor Ian Malcolm at Indiana State University.
I love that you picked a school.
Who teaches chaos theory at Indiana State. Starts dating a young Hispanic student of his. He's an alcoholic professor. He's cheating on his wife, and he's having a relationship with this young Hispanic student who, upon realizing that he has impregnated her, realizes...
Jesus Christ.
Yes, she's pregnant, and they agree that she needs to get an abortion. But he has a lot of affection for this girl and realizes that she's an illegal immigrant. So he decides, because they can't take her to a legal doctor, they have to drive across the country. They have to drive across the country and get to Mexico, right? So it's a road trip film to get her. But in the road trip film, Dr. Ian Malcolm ends up falling for the girl, and they make it to Mexico, and they decide to stay in Mexico and have the baby together.
And he leaves his wife.
Yes. He doesn't tell his wife. He just ups and disappears.
He just disappears.
Yeah.
These are not good movies.
It's called Chaos Trip.
I love that we had
No, maybe it's called Chaos Highway. I think Chaos Highway is the better title.
It is better, but that's why it should be called Chaos Trip. All right. If you guys have better pitches, which I'm sure you will, get them at us at AMA Podcast with Hashtag The Pitch.
You really don't think that that's a great film?
Illegal Immigration, Abortion, it's a good one. It's a 2017 film.
Yeah, I feel like it's a Hallmark movie.
Like a different, better film would probably get recognized for Best Picture, and then they'd call you out.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Not a knock on Moonlight. All right, so Steven Spielberg, I mean, we've talked about him a lot recently. Yeah, we've covered him on the show several times.
Yep. It's probably the third or fourth.
He's made over $8.5 billion at the box office for his films. He made $250 million for this film, which is the most anyone has ever made from any film ever.
Yeah, it's a crazy stat.
Yeah, he had the two most successful films at the box office domestically ever back-to-back, which was E.T. followed by Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was beaten out by his rival, James Cameron, with Titanic and then Avatar. So, I mean, is there anything else you want to throw in? Oh, actually, this fact is really cool if you want to talk about that. The thing down here about him doing Schindler's List.
Yeah, this was really cool. So
Schindler's List went for, what, like a year almost?
Yeah, so Schindler's List is the same year as Jurassic. Mm-hmm. They're both 93, right?
Yeah.
So he was in Poland filming Schindler's List while doing post via video link chat with for this movie. And so what I read was,
it's
crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. He later called it one of the hardest times in his life as a filmmaker because the filming of the Holocaust-themed Schindler's List took such an emotional toll on him that his enthusiasm for Jurassic Park had almost waned. He said that he needed an hour per day to get into the right frame of mind and muster up the energy and patience to comment on digital dinosaurs and answer trivial questions from the special effects crew. Crazy story.
It chills. Like, yeah. Literal chills because, yeah, man.
He's Jewish.
He's doing Jewish, Schindler's List. He's doing one of the hardest movies. I mean, Saving Private Ryan, The Pianist, and Schindler's List are three of the absolute hardest films to watch ever. And clearly for him, too, because he is Jewish. And, like, yeah, man, how do you do that every night? Like, during the day, you're dealing with building sets of actual gas chambers and people dying. You're working with emaciated extras on set all day that weigh less than 100 pounds. And then it's like, yeah, but the dinosaur shooting the acid in the face of Newman doesn't really sell right.
Yeah.
Like, that's just crazy to me.
Shut the fuck up!
He's like, you don't even know! But to speak to his talent and patience, he did it.
He did
it really well.
And he made two of the great films ever made.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's all we need to cover with Spielberg.
Yeah, so aside from that, the two major producers on the film, Kathleen Kennedy of Kennedy Marshall, married to Frank Marshall, and Gerald R. Mullen. Gerald R. Mullen is a frequent contributor of Steven Spielberg. He retired in the mid-2000s, going all the way back to the late 70s. He worked on Tootsie. Winning Oscars for Rain Man and Schindler's List, worked on The Color Purple, Minority Report.
Mm-hmm.
Big producer for a number of years, for roughly 20 years. He was big in the game, and 20, 30 years, and like, semi-retired at this point, kind of doesn't really frequent the film business anymore. Kathleen Kennedy, what did I read here? With over $6 billion in domestic box office receipts, she is Kennedy is the third only to Spielberg and Stan Lee in domestic box office receipts.
Yeah, with over $6 billion in December 2015. And then down here, you go, overall, Kennedy's work has included over 60 films, 120 Academy Award nominations, and over $11 billion worldwide, including the three highest grossing films in motion picture history.
Three of them, excuse me.
Which is, you know, she's like the Bruce Berman of the female world.
She's, but way bigger.
But bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's like almost as big as it gets.
Yeah. She's crazy.
Probably. I would say if you were making the Hollywood Power List, I mean, she's probably top 15, top 10.
Yeah, and then for women, like top 5.
She probably the most. I mean, who's bigger?
Like, are you talking production-wise?
Yeah, I mean, she's...
Oh, probably no one then. She's more, maybe like Bigelow? Like, if you're talking, like, women in Hollywood?
I think she's got to hold more clout than anyone.
Yeah. Those numbers are... That's unprecedented. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if we're wrong about that. If we were more tuned into the high-stakes producer world of Hollywood, we'd follow a little more of the creative side.
Exactly. This is a perfect segue into what we're talking about next, which is box office and critical. This movie only cost $63 million to make, which is astounding.
Astounding,
yeah. Absolutely. It was made by Universal in 93. It was released in June, summer blockbuster. It grossed $402 million domestic, an additional $626 million worldwide for $1.029 billion in 93.
Yeah. 93, unadjusted. $1.029 billion. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Crossing the billion border is... it's insane. Even nowadays when it happens, it's insane.
At the time, it was the highest grossing film ever made.
Yeah. See, that was all we got there. Yeah, so critically, this is an 8.1. It's number 205 on the top 250, which it needs to be on the top 250. It's just one of those movies. It just has to be.
Absolutely.
It doesn't really follow our algorithm, which makes sense because... actually, it doesn't make sense to me. Why is it, so All Critics is a 93.
Yep.
Top Critics is an 88, and the audience is a 91.
I would think audience was 100.
I would too. I released 98.
Yeah.
Why? Why do you think that is?
I really don't know. That's very surprising to me. It's one of the only examples I can think of. This is like an exact kind of movie where the audience score feels like it should be the highest.
Exactly. And all of them should be in the 90s.
Yeah. I don't know who would give this movie an 88, but when you get to older movies, we've said this before, the percentages get a little weirder the older you get.
Yeah.
And there was 117 reviews to pull from, but even so, I don't really understand it.
So it won 3 Oscars for visual effects, sound effects, and sound editing. It was nominated for a few more. It makes sense. It should.
I guess that's what we've got for that. Sorry, I had a hiccup there. Let's get into the last part of the show here, guys. Favorite line. This is your favorite line in the film, something you think is totally awesome. Pretty straightforward. There's a lot. They're all Goldblum.
Honestly, all the best lines are Goldblum, other than, we have a T-Rex.
Yeah.
That one's great, but, I mean...
You bred raptors?
Yeah.
Bred raptors?
Yeah, it's just anything Goldblum says at any time in the film, no matter how he says it.
Magic. I think my favorite Goldblum line is when he's like... it's Samuel's like, are you married? And he's like, occasionally. And he's like, and then he's like, I'm always on the lookout for future Mrs. Malcolm. It's such a good line.
I also love the, now I'm just sitting in a car by myself talking to myself. That's chaos theory.
Yeah.
Just like, shut up.
Yeah,
shut up.
Yeah, and then he's in the back of the car, must go faster.
Yeah, must go faster. Same line, same delivery as Independence Day, must go faster. what else? Everything he does is fantastic.
Yeah, it's tremendous. Just the whole, his whole character, the leather, all of it, is just like...
The hair, the leather, the glasses, the chest.
Yeah, it's weird. I think that, like you said, 90s Goldblum's highly underrated by today's standards, because like, you forget how wonderful he is. He is truly the star of the movie. And I have to say, guys, I know it's been a couple years since we did the episode for Independence Day, but when you go back to watch Independence Day, it breaks down like this. The Bill Pullman speech is the number one best part of that movie.
Yep.
The number two best part is every time Goldblum is on screen, and arguably the worst part is any scene that Will Smith has before he settles down and has scenes with Goldblum. His scenes with Goldblum get better. His scenes before Goldblum are like kind of painful
to
watch.
Unbearable to watch. And the ones with Goldblum, it's like Goldblum's like reeling him in.
Yeah, Goldblum's just great.
And to Will Smith's defense, like when you have no one to play off of, and they're just like, just be crazy, Will.
Yeah.
That's what you get.
I mean, we've said this before and we'll say it again. There was this thing in the 90s. It was just this thing where it was like, Will Smith, you have been really, really successful as being the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and you've got this like cool, kind of like sassy, like very relatable guy from the hood angle. So why don't you do that? People like that. That's fun. And it's just like these unintelligent audiences that want you to do kind of a slightly racist portrayal of what a black man
is. It is completely racist portrayal of what people thought black people acted like. Like, Eddie Murphy, Orlando Bloom, Martin Lawrence, Chris Tucker, Rock.
Orlando Bloom?
What did I say? I wrote Orlando Jones here, and I said Orlando Bloom. And then Will Smith.
Yeah, Ice Cube, like, Anaconda. Make that dad is big. It's like, what are you doing?
No,
stop it.
No, you're not. Yeah, anyway, so it's just that kind of thing in the 90s. We've talked about it many times. You don't need to harp on it. It didn't translate well, and that's the biggest complaint. With Independence Day.
Yeah, for sure. So, hats off to the world for getting its head out of its ass and treating
mostly out of its ass.
Yes, definitely true. Half our country does not. So let's continue to move through the last bit of the show, which is the 3 action movie categories. There's 3 categories. Totally Ridiculous, Totally Legitimate, and Ridiculously Legitimate. Totally Legitimate movies are like Lone Survivor and The Fugitive. They hold together. They're very dramatic. They never fall apart. You never laugh unintentionally. Totally Ridiculous or like Con Air, Face Off, really silly movies. The Fifth Element, we kind of just like find ourselves laughing the whole time. And then, of course, the middle category, Point Break and Predator.
The Rock.
They're kind of our favorites. They combine the two. They're held together by some really strong elements, but you do find yourself kind of laughing and chuckling and being pretty amused.
I feel like this has to fall in that category.
Yeah.
I was originally going to say Totally Legitimate, but I think Dr. Ian Malcolm is just too awesome to not be put in the middle category. I know that's kind of weird to say.
Yeah.
But, like, the enjoyment out of him is it's enjoying him as a caricature.
Yeah,
you know, completely. It's like it's enjoying that ridiculousness. But I think that's why he's in the film, though.
Yeah,
that's why he's there. So I don't. What do you got?
Yeah, it's a tough sell because it's such really a good tough. Movie, but I think the middle category, ridiculously legitimate. I mean, the thing is, the ridiculously legitimate category doesn't necessarily always have to reference there's some element of the movie that's bad.
No, yeah, exactly.
But on the other hand, I think I'm going to swing into the favor of Totally Legit because I think every time you laugh at Ian Malcolm,
they're laughing too.
It's intentional.
Yeah.
The only one that I can think of is the him splayed out shirtless, which is seriously such an impactful moment in the movie, and it's so absurd that I almost think that moves it into the middle category.
Just that one move.
It's so big.
It's so ridiculous.
When you're watching the movie, it comes up, and you're like, if I was like, my son was watching with me, I'd be like, what the fuck is this? Like, I'd be like, what? Like, why did that happen? It's just like such a weird thing. By the end of it, you're like, all right, it's fine. He's just like, he's just like a stud. He's a rock star. Right. He literally looks like what a rock star would be doing lying there with his shirt splayed open. But it's just like so weird in a kid's movie that that's the character and that's the choice.
Oh, man.
So it almost makes it ridiculously legitimate for me.
Yeah.
But I think I have to stay totally legit.
I really want to put it in the middle category, but I think you're right. I don't think you actually. Please tell me that the audience can see that because that is wonderful.
Oh, you know it,
oh, it's so good. I think I'm gonna agree.
What the fuck is that?
Yeah, right. What is happening here? I'm gonna say it totally legit, even though it does feel like the middle category. It does feel more like those movies.
Yeah.
But there isn't anything that pulls it out of the totally legit category.
Yeah, I agree. Yep. We haven't even talked about how good Richard Attenborough is.
He's just fantastic.
Did you read that thing about he's directing Richard Attenborough after losing to him for Attenborough directing Gandhi in 82, the same year he lost to Gandhi at the Oscars?
For Best Picture, then the previous year he lost Best Director, right,
Maybe it was he lost Best Director, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, Attenborough did you read the other thing about the storm? The hurricane?
No, maybe not.
So throughout this, there was the famous storm that the hurricane Inca or whatever it was.
Oh, yes, I did read this.
Yeah, and during the storm, the one night in the hotel, the cast and crew, they were all forced. Every single person on the cast and crew had to go to the ballroom for safety. And they ended up moving production back to L.A. because the storm did not relent. But that night, during this crazy storm, Kathleen Kennedy kept referring to it as a freight train flying by 120-mile-an-hour winds relentlessly throughout the night.
Yeah.
And Attenborough, in the morning, he had slept through the entire thing, stayed in his room. And they're like, how did you do that?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, my dear, I survived the breach or something like some battle that he'd been in. And it was just like one of those things. It's like, look, dude, I've been in war.
Yeah.
I can sleep through a fucking storm.
Yeah.
It was just so cool. He didn't even wake up during a hurricane.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the man. He's so good in this movie. He's just so good.
He's incredible. And like the heartbreak that he has for things not working is incredible.
Yeah, he's really great. So guys, there's only one category left on the show, and that is called The Pitch. We've got a really exciting one. This is episode 98. We've got two episodes left. One until 100.
Yeah.
And episode 99 is a really exciting one.
It's a big one.
It's the Raid Redemption.
The Raid, yeah, and you've never seen
it. I've never seen it. I've been waiting this whole time to watch it with Drew, and he's been filming this movie. We haven't had time, but we're going to watch it together. We're going to cover it on the show. A lot of you guys have been waiting for this movie for a long time. The Raid Redemption coming up next week. Can't freaking wait.
I can legitimately say the best fight scenes I've seen in movies in the last decade or more.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yep, there you go. Agreed. It's absolutely...
the sequel.
Yeah, and the sequel was... Yeah, we'll get there, obviously, but I'm so excited to talk about The Raid. I hope that you guys enjoyed watching us on the Movie Trivia Schmodown.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for watching that. It was heartbreaking for us to lose the way we did.
1 point, Ben knew both the answers, and his buzzer was going off.
It was literally milliseconds late, and... it was just such a hard-fought battle.
Yeah.
Gigantic congratulations to those losers!
Those assholes, the Nerds Watch.
Yeah,
incredibly well fought. The only ever fourth overtime on the Schmodown. We went into quadruple overtime, and they didn't say this, and Christian might get mad if we talk about it, but Ben had an incredible challenge
during that saved us.
In overtime, like after we'd lost something, and he was like, no, it's a challenge, we got it. Anyway, it was... one of the greatest experiences ever. And if you haven't watched the match, you gotta go.
Watch it. We're hoping that we'll be back for a rematch sooner than later.
Yep.
So guys, thank you so much for watching. Thanks for listening. This has been Action Movie Anatomy on the Popcorn Talk Network. Thanks for sticking with us for 98 episodes. We're almost there to 100, guys, and we promise there's some very exciting news coming up with episode 100. Some really big stuff. That's what we're doing. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you guys want to follow along with us, you can follow the show at AMA Podcast. You can follow me at Andrew Guy on Instagram and Twitter.
You can follow me at Ben Bateman Media. We didn't even mention this one time, but Goldblum did confirm as Dr. Ian Malcolm in Jurassic World 2.
That's
a big piece of news that we just totally
like a big part of why we're doing this
just
show.
Whiffed on it. So yeah. Anyway, guys, thank you so much for watching. Thanks for listening, and we will see you guys same time, same place next week.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.